Goethe in Marienbad by Christopher Bamford. We begin with an epigraph from the Soothsayings of Bacchus by Goethe. Eternal will be for you the one that self divides into the many, and remaining one remains eternally the only one. Find the many in one, feel the many as one, then you will have the beginning, the end of art. Appropriately, if only by name, the legendary Bohemian spire of Marienbad is oddly a place of alchemical associations, harking back as it does to the legendary alchemist Maria the Jewess, Divine Maria, or Maria Prophetessa, the supposed sister of Moses, who was the inventor, among other alchemical apparatuses, of the celebrated Balneum Mariae, or the Bain-Marie, the double boiler. Maria is the source of one of the central alchemical axioms. She wrote, "One becomes two, two becomes three, and out of the third comes the fourth as the one." Or, in another version, "One becomes two, two becomes three, and by means of the third and the fourth achieves unity. Thus two are but one." She also said, "Join the male and the female, and you will find what is sought." Or more alchemically stated, "Marry gum with gum in true marriage." Goethe, to my knowledge, does not mention Maria. But as we shall see, he certainly lived by her principles. For Goethe's whole work, all fragments, as he says, of a great autobiography, is hermetic, through and through. His poetry, novels, and dramas, no less than his science, which is explicitly so. Continuing with alchemical associations surrounding Marienbad, there is also the odd, possibly hermetic fact that it was Josef Jan Neher, the doctor of the nearby Premonstratensian monastery of Tepla, who at the end of the 18th century began to promote the healing properties of the mineral springs belonging to the order. Until then, only locals knew of them because of their inaccessible location deep in a rugged valley. The Premonstratensians had always included alchemy, hermeticism, and medicine among their interests, and therefore it is not unlikely that a hermetic motive in the largest sense inspired both the doctor and the abbot, Karl Caspar Reitenberger, a personal friend of Goethe, and perhaps even inspired them to name their spa as they did. Hermetic and Herculean, likewise, was the effort to reclaim the inhospitable terrain. Vast amounts of earth had to be moved, ravines filled in, bogs drained, in all a staggering job of landscaping, recalling the end of Faust Part II, when Faust himself is engaged upon such a project of raising nature into art. Which, if any of these associations, most appealed to Goethe is unknown. But he began visiting the spa in the summer of 1819, 11 years after the first spa house was built. He had just published his East-West Divan, his homage to the peerless Persian poet Hafiz, the only full-length lyrical work he published in his lifetime. Celebrated as the first work of world literature, the Divan was intended to overcome the dichotomy of East and West by raising it to a higher unity. The title page is in both German and Persian, as are the half-titles of the 12 books that make up the collection of more than 200 poems. But the title itself is not simply translated. In typical Goethean fashion, its apparent unity actually conceals a duality. Facing the German text, West Easterly Poetry Collection, the Persian reads, "The Eastern Poetry Collection of a Western Author." Thus the German sounds a dialogical or synthetic note, whereas the Persian indicates something more unified and provides a more integral, monological, or unified note. The poems themselves, Sufi-like invocations of divine and human love are dense and elusive in their language, which draws on both the Bible and the Quran, as well as Persian and Western traditions. Multiple unattributed citations from East and West are embedded in the text. The whole work echoes, then, the emerging sense of the Eastern origin of the Bible, which cast doubt on the supposed opposition between East and West by demonstrating that religion was one and oriental in origin. Who knows self and other will cognize here that East and West are to be divided no more. The West is God's, the East is God's, northern and southern lands rest in the peace of his hands. He, the only just one, makes justice for everyone. Of his 100 names, let this one be highest praised. Amen. Goethe had always been interested in Oriental studies, and above all, Islam. Over the years, he read and reread the Quran intensively, making his first notes in Hebrew and Arabic when he was only 21. Throughout his life, in fact, he studied and collected Arabic handbooks, grammars, travel books, and whatever translations of Eastern poetry and philosophy he could find. As a collector, he bought original manuscripts of Rumi, Hafiz, Attar, and others. Himself an accomplished penman, he admired Arabic calligraphy and was delighted when a page, the last surah of an antique Quran, came his way. All this came to a head in 1814. In May, his publisher Cotta sent him a copy of Josef von Hammer-Purgstall's translation of the complete poems of Hafiz. Overwhelmed, Goethe recognized the kindred spirit, another self. So close did he feel to Hafiz that he almost believed that in another lifetime he himself had lived, loved, and strolled in the gardens of Shiraz. In June he wrote, "So, Hafiz, may your charming song, your holy example, lead us as the glasses clink to our Creator's temple." Just then, too, Russian Muslim soldiers were billeted in Weimar. "Who would have dared to say a year or two ago," Goethe wrote to a friend, "that a Mohammedan service would be held in the hall of our Protestant grammar school and that the surah of the Quran would be murmured there?" Perhaps he experienced a kind of conversion then, for as he said later, "the poet does not refuse the suspicion that he himself is a Muslim." Emotionally, however, this was not a good time for Goethe. His marriage was becoming more difficult. The burdens of his official position oppressed him. So he did what he always did in such situations. He went in search of love. On July 25, he left Weimar for Frankfurt, his old home. The journey was extremely productive. Powerful, inspired poems came down. Above all, the one called Holy Yearning. "Tell it to no one, only to the wise, because the crowd will only mock. What lives will I praise? What yearns for death by flame? In the coolness of the love nights that begot you, where you begot, a strange feeling comes over you while the still candle shines. No longer are you hemmed in by the shadow of darkness, and a new longing rends you for a higher copulation. No distance is difficult. You fly onward and enchanted, and finally, passionate for the light, butterfly, you are burned. As long as you do not have this, die and become. You are but a cloudy guest on the dark earth." By the end of August, 30 poems existed, and he had met an old banker friend, Johann Jakob Willemer. Willemer introduced Goethe to his longtime little friend, Marianne Jung. This dear little woman would become Goethe's inspiration, his Zuleika, and a co-conspirator in the divan. Later, thinking of Marianne, Goethe would speak of a temporary rejuvenation, a repetition of puberty. explaining, "This can happen to outstandingly gifted people, even during old age, while other people are young only once." For Goethe, such a renewal of the springtime of human life was a rule, the means of new birth, of dying and becoming. Though the relationship with Marianne was completely secret, and nothing in a physical sense happened, Willemer must have sensed something, for on September 27th, on Goethe's insistence, he married her after 18 years of cohabitation. Nevertheless, in October, Goethe and Marianne spent 9 unforgettable days together in Frankfurt. Poems continued to be written, and Goethe, having named Zuleika, gave himself a name, Hatem. "Now that you are called Zuleika, I should also have a nickname. When you praise your beloved, Hatem is the name to use." Following summer, Goethe enjoyed 6 long weeks with the Willemers. In the morning, he wrote, appearing at noon in his frock coat. In the afternoons, a walk. In the evenings, dressed in his white flannel robe, the master read poems, mostly from the divan, and Marianne played her 8-string guitar and sang folk songs. Goethe gave her a copy of all he had written so far for the divan. Mysteriously, he noted in his journal, "Divan, beginning, end." What only he and she knew was that he had also given her a poem, Hatem. It's not opportunity that makes a thief, because it itself is the greatest thief. It stole what was left of the love that still remained in my heart. It handed over to you the sum of all my fortune, so that now, penniless, I depend on you alone for sustenance. Already in the jewel of your glance, I feel your mercy. I enjoy within your arms a destiny renewed." And that a few days later, Marianne had returned with a poem of her own, Zuleika. Goethe made a few corrections, copied it, and placed it with the other manuscripts. Marianne was to write 3 other poems. They have been called the most beautiful poems written by a German woman, and they, likewise unattributed, became part of the divan. Here truly was unity in duality. This accomplished, Goethe hastened to Heidelberg to confer with Orientalists and biblical critics, and to deepen his study of Arabic and Persian. His grail? To discover and reconcile in himself, in a new, higher unity, the multiplicity of monotheism's divine expressions. Such unity was always Goethe's goal, for he well understood the alchemical truth that unity only divides in order to find itself again in a higher sense. As he himself once wrote, "Anything that enters the world of phenomena must divide in order to appear at all. The separated parts seek one another again and may find each other and be reunited. In the lower sense, by mixing each with its opposite, that is, by simply coming together with it, in which case the phenomenon is nullified or at least becomes indifferent. But the union can also occur in the higher sense, whereby the separated parts are first developed and heightened, so that the combination of the two sides produces a third, higher being of a new and unexpected kind." Just then, the Willemers themselves appeared in Heidelberg. Goethe took Marianne into the castle grounds, where he showed her a ginkgo tree. Presenting her with a ginkgo leaf, he suggested something of its secret meaning by asking, "Is it one thing that divides into two, or two that unite into one?" On their last day together, September 26, walking through the park, he inscribed Zuleika in the sand in Arabic. Goethe and Marianne would never meet again. Filled with emotion, Goethe plunged again into the study of Persian. The next day he sent her the poem Ginkgo Biloba, which he would place in the book of Zuleika. "This tree's leaf, which from the east is entrusted to my garden, Let us taste a secret meaning that edifies the learned. Is it one living being that divides itself in itself? Are there two who select themselves so we know them as one? To reply to such a question, I found, I think, the right sense. Do you not feel in my poems that I am one and I am doubled? The two lovers become one in love, unity. But unity, which is love, is conditioned by duality. Hatem and Sulaika are two, as is Goethe himself, who both loves and writes about it. His life is doubly double, hermaphroditic and inward and outward. He is both male and female, within and without. He lives and writes, is both subject and object, but what he praises and becomes is one, the unity of lover and beloved. To achieve this unity requires renunciation. To become love, he must renounce both himself and the beloved. All this is hermetic. The opening poem of the Divan, Hegira, announces, North, west, and south are shattering. Thrones burst apart, empires shake. Flee then to the pure east. Taste the air of the patriarchs. There, with love, wine, and song, Kidda's fountain will make you young again. Kidda, a legendary figure in esoteric Islamic lore, is the green or emerald one, the source of all greening vegetation, freshness of spirit, and eternal liveliness. He is a supra-earthly being, the throne of the angel of humanity, the true and only initiator of all saints, sages, and prophets, including Moses himself, as the Quran states. His fountain is none other than the fountain of life. His wisdom, drawn from the living sources of life, is the divine science of creation, and his disciples form the invisible, trans-historical, spiritual order of those who have become truly free. Having attained the source of life and drunk the waters of immortality so that he knows neither old age nor death, Kidda, the verdant one, is the master of the alchemical elixir of life, the philosopher's stone. The Divan appeared in 1819. Marianne continued to write to Goethe sporadically, remembering his birthday, sending him poems, and never forgetting the ginkgo leaf. It lets me savor a secret meaning that edifies the one who loves. Goethe reciprocated, never forgetting her. In 1832, just before he died, 17 years after Hatem and Sulaika became figures of speech, he collected her letters. He called them letters pointing to the loveliest days of my life. He collected them into a packet and returned them to her, and he wrote, I would only like one promise, that you leave it open for an undetermined time. Letters of this sort give us the happy feeling that we have really lived. These are the most beautiful documents upon which we may rest. Nevertheless, the ending of that beautiful moment left a void in Goethe's life. His imaginal trip to the East and his travels to Frankfurt and Heidelberg would be the last journeys he would take, except for one. He was becoming too old for such distances. When the Divan appeared, he turned 70. He became a patriarch, a legend, a sage, but a lonely one. 3 years previously, in 1816, his wife, Christiane Vulpius, had died. His home life was chaotic and filled with dissension. Although he lived with his son, August, and daughter-in-law, Ottilie, and her sister, Ulrike, he could rely on no one. August was useless. Ottilie had no idea of housekeeping. Everything got dustier and dustier. Initially endearing herself to Goethe by her cultural aspirations, her instability soon turned her to a life of serial promiscuity. The marriage in pieces, August did the same. And amid the chaos, Goethe suffered, although in great style. Weimar had become the Goethe shrine. Visitors came daily to see him. He felt like a piece of statuary, a tourist attraction. Inspiration being out of the question, it seemed, he turned to putting his papers into order. He assembled his Italian journey, using his old letters. He collected his campaign in France from his old diaries. Finally, he dictated the two volumes of his annals, the dry, day-by-day account of his life. When he did write poetry, it was mystical and obscure. In this mood, he began summering in Marienbad, now his favorite spa since he had exhausted the geology of Carlsbad. But it was not only Marienbad's geology that drew him thither. In 1821, by apparent chance, he had stayed in a pension run by a retired Prussian officer, Herr von Brüssiger, whose daughter, Amelie von Levertsov, he had met years before in 1806 when she was 19. Mysteriously, he had then noted in his diary, Pandora. Now she was 35, separated but not divorced, for her husband was a Catholic and she had three daughters. Her partner, a Count Klebelsberg, had built the pension where Goethe stayed for her parents. Goethe took to the daughters immediately. They had just the freshness and youthful vitality that he needed. He was particularly taken with Ulrika, the middle one, who was 17. She had just returned from finishing school in Strasbourg, where Goethe too had spent his student days. They spent hours together, chatting about the town where both had spent student days and about which Goethe had written at length. Much of this, however, was lost on Ulrika, who did not really know who the old man was. She called him the great scholar, yet Goethe appreciated her innocence. He spent his days geologizing and botanizing, and his evenings with Ulrika, telling of his finds. Since she did not make much of his stones, he slipped a piece of chocolate among them. That got her attention. After that, he brought her flowers. The following year, Goethe reunited with the Levertsovs. As usual, he attended the receptions, promenaded, went to the balls, and flirted with all the pretty girls. But clearly far away his favorite was Ulrika. Soon everyone was jealous of her. Only through her could one gain an introduction to the great man. Meanwhile, Goethe began to observe her with increasingly great emotion, carefully noting all the different attitudes that she presented. Gradually, but not unexpectedly, what began as a mere love interest turned into a great passion, though the lover was now 73 and the beloved but 18. Returning home to Weimar, Goethe's mood became tumultuous. He swung daily from ecstasy to depression. He fell ill. Some said he nearly died. In January, he noted in his diary, "I am imprisoned, as if in a deep, deep tomb." He was caught. Around the same time, he wrote, "If only I could flee from myself. The cup is over full. Why is it that I always strive for things not meant for me? Ah, if only one could be well again. What insufferable pains. Like a wounded serpent, it turns and twists in one's heart." In February, a darker mood seized him. Lamenting the, quotes, "masses of psychological stuff," quotes, "that have burdened me for 3,000 years. By summer, his feelings overwhelmed him. In an impassioned state, as he put it, he conceived the idea of marriage and consulted a doctor to discover whether the institution would be detrimental to his health. The doctor, with a smile, said it would not. Goethe then took the Grand Duke Karl August into his confidence and told him of his plans. At first the Grand Duke teased his old friend, but then, seeing he was deadly serious, was moved by the sight of this white-haired old man, the greatest man in Europe, begging him to be an intermediary. Accordingly, he played a formal call to Frau von Levertsov and presented her with Goethe's offer of marriage, even going so far as to assure her that Ulrika would always be taken care of financially. Gently but firmly, she turned him down. Somehow, even though the matter had been handled with the utmost delicacy, everyone knew of it. Letters flew in all directions. Goethe even wrote to his daughter-in-law, darkly alluding to his passion, and hinting at the possibility of the addition of a, quotes, third or, quotes, fourth person to their household. On the same day, amazingly, for the tragedy had yet to run its course, Goethe heard the beautiful Polish pianist Szymanowska play. He fell in love with her too, so unstable was his impassioned state. And he wrote in her album the verses on reconciliation that would conclude his trilogy of passion. Passion brings suffering. Who, anxious heart, can soothe you who have lost so much? Where are the hours so swiftly flown by? In vain was the greatest beauty chosen for you. The spirit is clouded, the undertaking confused. How the glorious world disappears from the senses. Then the music soars on angel's wings, tone upon tone, a million notes intertwining, penetrating the core of our inmost being and filling it with eternal beauty. The eyes moisten, and you feel with higher longing the divine value of tones and of tears. Thus, the heart is made light and quickly sees it still lives and beats and would still beat more in purest gratitude for this given gift, that it would return in willing offering of self. Then you feel, oh, that it would last forever, the double joy of music and love. Reconciliation was not yet, however, Goethe's present state. He would still propose marriage again himself. Again, gently, he was rejected. Hastily, the Levertsovs left Marienbad for Karlsbad. This was August 17. 3 days later, Goethe noted in his diary, "A quiet night, conciliatory dreams." Then on the 23rd, he too left Marienbad, supposedly to visit his friend Grüner in Eger, stopping on the way to gather more mineralogical samples. He is after what he calls undulatory slate, rich in flint, and pyrotypical stones of several kinds. From Eger, he sent Ulrika a poem, saying that she dwelled so much in his heart that he could not understand how she was elsewhere. Meanwhile, he talked with his friend Grüner about mineralogy and geology and visited the pharmacy to view its glass. All seemed fine, but in his diary also noted, quotes, "work on the poem of his agony." Finally, he arrived in Karlsbad, taking rooms at the same inn where the Levertsovs were staying. His were immediately above theirs. On the surface, things still went smoothly. August 28th was Goethe's 74th birthday. He told no one of it. It would be a secret. He would organize an excursion for that day. But when he came down to breakfast, he found in his place a cup on which a garland of ivy was painted. "Why the pretty cup?" he asked. "To remind you of our friendship," he was told. Ivy is the symbol of friendship. Later, at the picnic, he was given a glass on which the names of Frau Levertsov and her three daughters were engraved. "Despite it all," she said, "we don't want to be forgotten. Remember us always, and also this occasion." The days following unfolded like those at Marienbad, social events punctuated by mineralogical expeditions. Ulrika read to him from Sir Walter Scott. In his diary, Goethe noted, "On the whole, she reads well and without affectation, but she ought to read with more energy and vivacity." On the morning of September 15, after a tumultuous farewell, Goethe left, and as the carriage rolled along, he began to compose to its rhythm and with perfect objectivity the main section of the Trilogy of Passion, the Marienbad Elegy. Goethe knew well, as he had written in his play Torquato Tasso, and echoed in the first poem of the trilogy, to Werther, "When a person is speechless in his pain, a god will help him speak his suffering. By October, the guard had spoken. On October 23, Goethe asked his amanuensis Ackermann to stay a little later than usual. As the gloom of dusk grew deeper, Goethe asked his servant to bring in and light 2 exquisite wax tapers. Ackermann was to read something. Goethe brought in the Trilogy of Passion. It was calligraphed in perfect Roman characters on the finest vellum paper and fastened with a silken cord into a red Morocco case. When Ackermann had finished reading, Goethe said, using Frankfurt slang, "Gelt? That is, well, ain't it so? Haven't I shown you something pretty good?" The next month, November, the pianist, Madame Simonowska, played in Weimar. Goethe was asked to propose a toast in her memory. He cried out, "I do not suffer memory in the sense you mean. Whatever enters our life that is great or beautiful or important is not to be remembered merely from without, hunted down, as it were, but from the start it must be woven into the very heart of our being, united with it, so that it might create within us a better self, and thus live on in us eternally active. There is no past for which we have a right to long. There is only what is eternally new, formed from the expanded elements of what have gone before. True longing must always be productive, must always create something new and better." After La Simonowska left, Goethe collapsed. Word was that he was near death, but when his friend Zelter visited him, he saw the truth, noting in his diary, "I stand at the door. Is there death in the house?" August comes. "Father is not well, ill, very ill." I approach closer. "What shall I find? What do I find? Someone who looks as if his body is racked with love, all the love of youth with all its agony. Well, if that is what it is, he will get over it. No, he must keep it. He must burn like quicklime." Burn he did, and rise from the dead he did, and the poem, ritually unveiled for Ackermann with candles like a sacred text, remained for him a numinous thing, a gift of the gods. He gave it 3 parts. The first part, to Werther, was written to celebrate the 50th birthday of his famous early work, The Sufferings of Young Werther, which had made him celebrated throughout Europe and set off a rash of sympathetic suicides for love's sake. For Goethe, this was not an occasion for looking back, for once again he was himself in the same situation as Werther was, still in love with nature, in love with love, and caught in love's magnetic lure in a woman's form, separating, dying in a very particular, particular love. Confused strivings between inside and outside still tore him apart. Perhaps, after all, Werther took the right decision. "I chose to remain, you to depart. You went ahead and have not lost much." After all, as always for Goethe, yet again the farewell awaits, as if there were no higher life without death, as if life were not, if rightly lived, a continuous dying and becoming. He ends, "You smile, friend, full of feeling as befits you. A horrible separation made you famous. We celebrated your wretched ill fate. You left us behind for better or worse. Then once again, an uncertain path of passion drew us into its labyrinth. And entangled in repeated need, we end once more in separation. Separation is death." But how stirring it sounds when the poet sings to avoid the death that separation brings. Half guilty and caught up in such torments, may a god give him to say what he suffers. What the god gives him is the Marienbad elegy itself. It is an astonishing performance. Hardly Wordsworth's emotion recollected in tranquility. It is the thing itself, not subjectively, but in its own suchness. After beginning with his act of gratitude, though in their torment most people fall silent, a God has given me the power to say what I suffer. Goethe continues almost theologically, what can I now hope for from this reunion, from this day's still closed blossoms? Paradise and hell stand open before me. How fickle-mindedness rules in my heart. But enough of doubt. She steps to heaven's door. She lifts me into her arms. And I was received into paradise, as if I deserved eternal, beautiful life. No wish, no hope, no desire was left me. Here was the goal of my inmost aspiration. Beholding this singular beauty, the source of my yearning tears was overcome. The day passed in gentle bliss until, with a chaste last kiss, cruelly sweet, the splendid tissue of intertwining love was ripped apart. It was as if a fiery cherub drove him out of paradise. The gate closed, his heart, filled with remorse, despair, likewise shut, as if never opened. Yet the world's beauty, nature in all her fecund glory, was still there. The canopy of the cosmos still poured its invisible powers upon the earth. Even in the blue ether, she floated toward him seraphim-like, the loveliest of loveliest forms. But perhaps that was a fiction. Better hold her in his heart. How she had welcomed him! How each act had inscribed her in his heart, which would preserve itself for her and preserve her forever in eternal gratitude. He had thought love was lost until she appeared. Then within his heart she became a sign of hope renewed and faith and peace. In the purity of our heart, a striving stirs to surrender ourselves in voluntary gratitude to a higher, purer unknown. Unriddling the eternally unnamed. We call this state piety, a blessed height. I feel in part when I stand before her. Before her, all self-seeking melts away. In her presence, all self-interest and self-will disappear. She teaches only the goodness of life as it exists from moment to moment. One need only look each moment in the eye, be childlike. Then one will be all things and invincible. Yet she is gone. What does that moment demand? Tears? Frenzy? A heart split open and a life and death struggle? Pain? Solitude? More tears? So Goethe ends. Leave me here, true companions. Leave me alone with the rocks, marsh, and moss. Hold to your paths. To you the world is open, the earth is wide, the sky sublime and great. Observe, research, and gather the details. Nature's secret will be stuttered out. I have lost the all. I have lost myself. I, who have been the darling of the gods, who tested me and gave me Pandora, who is so rich in blessings and richer still in dangers. They pressed me to bountiful lips, cut me from them, and destroyed me. In every great separation, Goethe wrote in his Maxims and Reflections, lies a seed of madness. One has to be careful not to foster its growth. Such partings are death, and one could die. Goethe, of course, does not. There is reconciliation, as we know. There is always a higher longing still, a dying into which we are reborn. Goethe's great theme in poetry, in science, in fiction, in drama, in human relations, as in life, was always unity in multiplicity or division. And multiplicity in unity. As he put it in his theory of color, to divide what is united and unite what is divided is the very life of nature. This is the eternal systole and diastole, the eternal synchrasis and diachrasis, the rhythmical breathing of the world in which we live and move and have our being. Like the old alchemist Maria, Goethe knew that creation and consciousness arise as primal love between one and two, unity and duality. He understood that in the moment that unity looks at itself, it sexualizes or polarizes and begins the sequential processes of expansion and contraction, whereby, reuniting, it becomes conscious of itself. Years of patient observation and study of nature, society, and his own heart had taught him how unity divided to become a field of love that unfolded through embodied affinities. Over and over again, he had seen how these affinities, through their perpetual self-transcendence, determined the harmony of the relationships specifying the individualized powers of the universe, all yearning to be brought together again in unity. In everything Goethe did, whether in science, poetry, drama, or fiction, he sought to realize the famous adage attributed to Astyanus: nature rejoices with nature, nature conquers nature, nature restrains nature. For Goethe, the name of this nameless one, many, many one is nature. Goethe's great love was always nature, and nature was love, and nature was the all. For him, the love that was Hildegard's greening power of nature, Dante's love that moves the stars, and the love that brought two human beings into unity was a single love. One sees this clearly in his famous early poems, May Song and Ganymede. How gloriously nature shines! How the sun glitters! How the meadow laughs! Buds burst from every twig, a thousand voices from every bush. Joy and delight from every breast. O earth, O sun, O happiness, O desire! O love, golden, beautiful as the morning clouds on yonder hill. Maiden, maiden, how I love you, how your eye glances, how you love me. As the lark loves singing and air, and morning flowers love heaven's fragrance, so I love you with warm blood. You give me youth and joy and courage, and new songs and dances. How in the morning's radiance you glow all around me, spring, my beloved. How with love's thousand delights, your eternal warmth, your holy feeling, and unending beauty press upon me. Oh, if I could hold you in these arms. At your breast I lie, I languish. Your flowers, your grasses press on my heart. You cool my breast's burning thirst, sweet morning breeze, where the nightingale calls out amorously to me from the misty valley. Nature was always and everywhere for Goethe one with the eternal womanhood that he celebrated at the end of his Faust, when he wrote, "Everything transitory is only a symbol. The unattainable here becomes event. The indescribable, here it is done. Eternal womanhood draws us on." Nature for Goethe was all. As he wrote in an early piece, "Nature, we are surrounded and embraced by her, powerless to step out of her and powerless to enter deeper into her. Unceasingly she shapes new forms. Whatever she does is new, yet always the same. She is the only artist, working up the simplest material into utter opposites and arriving without a trace of effort at the greatest perfection, at the most exact precision, always veiled beneath a certain softness. Each of nature's works has its own distinct essence, yet all form one eternal life. Becoming and movement are in her, but she does not advance. She changes eternally and never rests. She has always thought and always thinks, but not as human beings think. Above all, Goethe claims, her crown is love. Only through love can one come close to her. She makes abysses between all beings, and all desire to intermingle. She isolates all in order to draw all together, holding a couple of draughts from the cup of love to be fair compensation for the pains of a lifetime. In his Metamorphoses of Plants, Goethe had showed that from seed to seed, a plant was only leaf, metamorphosing through a seven-stage process of contraction and expansion. While his treatise appears to be purely botanical, Goethe alludes at its beginning to its being something more. He calls the complete process, whose summit is reached in the union of the sexes, a spiritual ladder. Elsewhere, he refers to metamorphosis in the higher sense, saying that it had already been excellently portrayed by Dante. Both of these metamorphoses are processes of purification, the progressive spiritualization of matter, renunciation, or death and resurrection, and ennobling, around and creative of a central point. The end point, the seed, described as, quotes, the highest degree of contraction and the development of its inward self, comes after the hermaphroditic union of male and female in the corolla, from which fruit and then seed emerge. It is in fact clear that just as the old alchemists saw all processes as essentially those of sulfur and mercury, so Goethe understood the metamorphoses of plants as an unfolding sequence of conjunctions or unions, deaths and resurrections between male and female elements. As in nature, so in poet too, who is nature too. In his Divan, Goethe writes a poem called Reunion. Can it be, star of stars, do I press you to my heart again? Then the night of separation, what abyss, what pain. Yes, it is you, my friend, sweet, beloved counterpart. I recall past sufferings, I shudder before the present. When the world lay in deepest depths in God's eternal bosom, he ordained the first hour with sublime creative desire and spoke the word, let it become. Then a painful cry rang out as the all in a gesture of power shattered into separate realities. Light opened, shyly darkness separated from it, and straightway the elements dividing flew asunder. Swiftly then, in wild, chaotic dreams, each pushed to the distances, becoming rigid in unmeasured spaces, without longing, without tone. All was mute, still, and empty. For the first time, God was lonely, so he created the dawn, who took pity on the torment of separation, and developed through the gloom a sounding play of color, so that what had fallen apart could now love again. Then, with hasty striving, those belonging to each other sought each other, and feeling and gaze returned to immeasurable life. Let each one seize and even snatch the other, if they can but grasp and hold. Allah needs create no more, for we are now creating the world. Thus, with wings of dawn, I was drawn to your lips. Star bright night with its thousand seals now empowers our union. Exemplary are we two on earth in joy and pain. No second, let it become, will separate us a second time. Goethe here is truly amazingly prescient. Whoever the dawn is, she is clearly an intermediary and a figure of Sophia, or wisdom. It matters little whether we call the two terms she mediates heaven and earth, spirit and matter, God and humanity, or God and creation. She is in between, a veil that conceals and reveals both the medium of theophany or revelation and sheer human creativity itself. There is a hadith or saying that the prophet Muhammad attributes to the Creator. I was a hidden treasure and yearned to be known. Therefore I produce creatures in order to be known in them. Perhaps Goethe knew this and knew how the Sufis, interpreting that saying, told the story of how the Creator suffered the solitude and sadness of not being known, and how his sadness and anguish at being unknown, because unnamed, unseen, unembodied, his desire to be known, unfolded in a Sophianic sigh of existentiating compassion, an all-surrounding cloud that, like a mirror, receives and gives beings their forms. We might call this being the absolute unconditioned imagination, the creative, active imagination. She is certainly that, but above all she is Sophia, divine feminine wisdom, the sole path to wholeness, who, as Solomon writes, rises from the power of God like a fine mist, a clear effluence from the glory of the Almighty. She is the radiance that streams from everlasting light, the flawless mirror of the active power of God. She is but one, yet can do all things. Herself unchanging, she makes all things new. Age after age, she enters into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets, for nothing is acceptable to God but the person who makes his home with wisdom. Dawn, nature, wisdom, the divine feminine, Goethe above all made his home with these. As for Eros, Goethe was certainly his servant, ultimately teaching devotion to him alone. He does not fail to come. He plunges down from heaven, whither he flew from the ancient void, to hover upon us on airy wings, round our brow and breast the whole spring through, now seeming to flee, now returning from his flight, mixing anguish in our well-being, sweetness and anxiety. The heart wanders lost in the many, but the noblest devotes itself to one alone.
Goethe and Marienbad was written and read by Christopher Bamford and is a BMA Studios presentation, holds the copyright there too. We hope you have enjoyed this audio download.